Okay, well, welcome everyone to our continuing seminars in a time of pandemic. And as I've said before, it's great that some of our people outside of Sydney can be in on the call like anyone within Sydney. So we're very grateful to Adam Crichton, who makes a welcome return to Sydney. And he's been here quite a few times before, but including during the pandemic. But he's currently, as those of us who read The Australian know, he's currently based in Washington, D.C. So I'll introduce him very briefly. Adam Crichton is the Washington correspondent for The Australian. Before that, he was The Australian's economic editor. And just in relation to the topic tonight, in around 2016, he spent 6 months in the United States working for the Wall Street Journal. Now, the topic today is the international economy, a view from the United States. So Adam Crichton's going to start off for about 20 minutes, and then we'll go to questions and discussion and finish no later than within the hour. So Adam Crichton, we're very grateful to you for doing this, and it's over to you to bounce the ball.
Okay, thank you very much, Jared, for that introduction, and thanks for having me back to the Sydney Institute. As you say, I've appeared a number of times before, and I very much enjoy the support and appreciate it. No, I was quite pleased that you asked me to speak about the economy, because I've been writing about COVID so much the past 2 years that's what I was always asked to talk about. So this is in some way putting my old hat back on, if you like, as economics editor. So I thought in my remarks I would give a brief overview of the US economy and where I see it at the moment, and then I'll broaden it out into an argument or a discussion, if you like, of the huge increase in public debt that we've seen throughout the world, and in particular in English-speaking nations, which I think is something that's not been commented on enough, actually. It's a cliche to say that there's a great deal of uncertainty about the economy. I think, you know, if you read the financial press, economists are always saying there's a great deal of uncertainty. It's a somewhat frustrating cliche, but I think it's more appropriate now than at least since the financial crisis to say that. We have been through in the last 2 years an extraordinary economic period, actually, in terms of policies that governments have pursued around the world, very, very unorthodox policies, if you like. And the US, if you like, has been at the forefront of those in terms of spending and so forth. I'll get to that a little bit later. Massive increase in public debt and so forth. The bottom line on the US now, superficial bottom line, if you like, is that everything's hunky-dory. Everything's going well. The jobless rate in the US is very low. We're back to 4% here, which is only slightly higher than it was at the beginning of 2020. And that historically is a very low unemployment rate. The stock market is very, very high. It's, you know, fallen a little, but still very, very high. So that suggests confidence for the future. Of course, inflation is up a little bit, but if you, the consensus is that it's going to fall again. It's going to gradually come down this year. But one of my points throughout is that the real costs, though, are not really embedded in these headline statistics yet. It's still too early to say whether it's been a success. So just starting off with the stock market that I mentioned earlier, something the former president used to love talking about, that it was at record highs. Well, it's worth pointing out that since February 2020, which was before the pandemic struck, the S&P 500, which is the main index here, that was at a record high then, and it's now 30% higher than it was there in February 2020, 30%, which is, you know, extraordinary increase in just 2 years. And since the decline, since the mini crash, if you like, at the start of the pandemic, where it fell quite considerably, it's now 88% higher than at that level. So the S&P 500, which is the benchmark, the broadest index of US stocks, and of course, that's a view to the future, if you like, because, you know, the stock price is discounted value of earnings going into the future, is still very, very bullish. And that's even with the, you know, prospect of war around the world. I mean, there's a high likelihood now that Russia and Ukraine will, you know, that there'll be a full-scale war in coming weeks, and that's factored into markets, and they still haven't fallen very much. So I think it's, you know, fair to say that it's a very positive indication of the future, the fact that stocks are so high here. I want to digress a little about COVID-19 here, because I think there's a perception in Australia that the US did nothing, so to speak, and and just let the virus rip. And that's very, very not true. I mean, the pandemic hit the US very, very hard. And I don't just mean in terms of lives lost, and there were certainly lots of lives lost, but in terms of the restrictions too, they were enormous, and they were just as large in many states as in many other countries around the world. You know, the most states in the US locked down very hard and multiple times throughout 2020 and 2021, and the country is still living with the legacy of those decisions. Jobs loss, for instance, were like greater as a proportion than almost any other Western country. I'll get to that a little bit later. And also restrictions of COVID are still very much in place, and they are politically very resonant. They are debated every day in the media, very viciously so and very vigorously so. So it's very much still an issue here. The economy overall has bounced back very strongly in the US, more strongly basically than any other Western country, which some economists put down to a relative free market system here. There are relatively fewer restrictions in general on the labor market compared to countries in Europe and Australia. So GDP growth, for instance, you know, the most important economic indicator, I guess, if you talk to economists. So last year, the US economy grew 5.5%. That's over the 12-month period to the end of last year. And that was the strongest growth rate since 1984. So, you know, extremely significant growth. Faster than the Australian economies rebounded, faster than European economies have rebounded. And indeed, in the final quarter of last year, the growth rate even accelerated. So it's, you know, it's still hasn't run out of steam. That said, the composition of GDP growth is quite different. Business investment is much, much lower than it would have been predicted based on 2019 trends. And that's perhaps not surprising given the huge uncertainty that I mentioned earlier. And especially for smaller businesses, if you're thinking of starting a business or thinking of expanding, the uncertainty around future COVID restrictions would certainly weigh heavily on your decision to invest. I mean, think, for instance, if you're on like in the accommodation business or the restaurant business or anything like that, you'd be extremely hesitant to expand or to invest given what might occur down the track. So the composition of GDP has changed. Also, I think it's important to know that the US economy, even though it's grown very strongly since March 2020, bouncing back from all the restrictions, it's still smaller than it would otherwise have been. You know, you hear politicians here and also in Australia, indeed every Western country, they're always saying how strong growth is, which is a good thing. But remember, the growth is from a very low base that they themselves created. So the restrictions came in, growth was crushed, the economic output was crushed, and economies around the world are slowly creeping back to where they were before. And even in the US, which as I said, has bounced back probably faster than any Western country, it's still 1.5% smaller of the US economy than it would have been had there been no pandemic. So it's still smaller. Now turning to the jobless rate and the unemployment rate, which I mentioned briefly earlier, that is back to 4%. But that said, that obscures quite dramatic changes in the labor market in the US, which I think, you know, have huge political resonance. The main change is the participation rate here has fallen so much. So many people have exited the labor force here during the pandemic. They've decided not to look for work anymore. And the total jobless rate, total employment rate here, if you like, is still $3 million workers smaller than it was in February 2020. So even though you have the unemployment rate back to roughly where it was in February 2020, that's based on a smaller potential workforce because people have left. So there are 3 million fewer jobs. And, you know, that's a huge difference, even in a country as large as the US, that you've seen that decline. Those people who are still working are working higher hours overall, and productivity is up. So you know, potentially you could say that some of the jobs that have vanished weren't as efficient or weren't as productive. So maybe long term you could make that's not necessarily a bad thing, but nevertheless, the labor market is $3 million workers smaller. And the number one challenge in the US, which I'm sure you've all heard about, is inflation. And it is a serious situation here. So, I mean, inflation in Australia, as I understand it, is still 3.5% or something like that over the past 12 months. But in the US, it's now 7.5%, which is the highest in 40 years. You know, that's quite something. And it's not just an aberration. It's not just a one-off. The inflation rate here has been above 5% for about 6 months, which is a very significant period of time. And it's not just a few items that are dragging up the index. Certainly petrol has gone up greatly here and so have gas prices. But even if you strip out petrol and food, they're the two volatile items that are often stripped out of the CPI. Inflation is still 6%, which is triple what it's meant to be according to the Federal Reserve, according to its promise to keep inflation at 2%. So a huge change. This occurred quite suddenly, you'd say. I mean, January, February last year, inflation was still very low. And then suddenly in March, April, it went up to 4%, and then it continued to accelerate. And this is despite, the president of the US, Joe Biden, saying that this inflation would be transitory, would be temporary. Federal Reserve officials said the same thing, that it would be transitory. And they kept saying this for a few months, but now they've given up on that rhetoric, including the White House, including the president. And inflation has continued to rise. And indeed, the most recent figure we have, as I said just earlier, was 7.5%. That is meant to be the peak, but the consensus is that the headline rate will gradually decline this year. But then again, the experts were completely wrong for all of last year. So who knows? And if the war between Russia and Ukraine escalates, the oil price is going to shoot up again greatly, and that's going to undermine all of these forecasts. So that is the most worrying situation. As I said, it's not just energy and food. I mean, to take one particular item, rent, which is of course extremely important for those on lower incomes. So rent is now rising in the US at the fastest pace in 20 years. So in January, it rose by 0.5% just in 1 month, which if you extrapolate across a year, is a huge increase. So the inflation issue is a huge deal. And of course, politically, this has massive consequences too. It's been a hugely undermining the Democrats' popularity here in the US and the president's in particular. He's now the most unpopular president, depending on how you define it. The most unpopular in modern history. He's recently on some polls dipped below President Trump, former President Trump. And it's largely because of the inflation problem. I mean, so many things that the media talks about are not relevant to ordinary Americans, but certainly inflation is. It's a very different economic problem from unemployment. Unemployment only affects those who are unemployed, and even a very bad unemployment rate is only going to be, 10% or something like that when it's very bad. But inflation affects every single voter. So it's particularly very toxic when it gets out of control. And it was in the 70s, it was in the 80s, and it could be again. That said, I do have some sympathy for the Biden administration here, because it's not necessarily the fault of the Democratic Party, I would say. I mean, they have inherited the policies of the Trump administration, and they've inherited the policies of, if you like, all Western governments in terms of spending much, much more during the COVID pandemic. You can argue that the $1.9 trillion that the White House spent last year as part of its pandemic measures was not necessary, because that came after about $3 or $4 trillion from the Trump administration. But since then, the Biden administration has not really done anything in a legislative sense. It's not spent greatly more. It's not changed many rules. So this inflation is occurring as a function of things that have happened in the past. Of course, it's going to get blamed for it, but it's hard to know what it can really do about it. The president in public and the White House have started to, you know, shift the blame to the Federal Reserve, which is fair enough because that is the responsibility of the Federal Reserve to keep inflation at 2%. And more and more, the Federal Reserve has been ratcheting up its the language kind of surrounding inflation and the level of concern it has about inflation. I think that is very clear. The outlook for interest rates is that they're going to come up, they're going to increase greatly this year. So about 1 month ago, the probability of seven interest rate increases this year was 1%. And according to financial market pricing, it's now about 70%. So there's been a huge increase in the likelihood of a number of interest rate increases. And in March, the expectation, so just next month, the expectation is that there'll be two interest rate increases in the same month. So from 0 to 0.5. Now, these sound like low rates of interest, but the consequences of even small interest rate increases from relatively low levels can be very significant for repayments and for pricing in financial markets. So the big question this year is you know, how does the central bank here increase interest rates without causing a recession or without crashing the US economy, which is like what happened in the late 80s when that's the last example of anything like this that we've seen, where there's a rapid increase in rates to reduce inflation. Now, we haven't got there yet, because like I said, this is the forecast. Forecasts are often wrong in central banking land and in economics land, so we don't know what's going to happen. But nevertheless, that is the forecast. Just moving to wages in the US. So they're rising very rapidly too, much, much faster than in Australia. They're up 5% over the last 12 months on average. But like I said, that's still a 2% decline because of the headline inflation rate. So the overall, even though the headline statistics of GDP and unemployment look pretty good, the inflation situation is undermining economic confidence. And ordinary Americans are very upset about the situation. I mean, if you look at all of the polling and surveys, they say that the economy is in a bad way, despite the strong GDP growth. In fact, the most important consumer sentiment index here, which is conducted by the University of Michigan, it just recently fell to the lowest level in 10 years. So it's lower now than it was in March 2020 when the pandemic struck. So that, you know, that was almost 2 years ago. So that gives you an idea of the despair, I guess, and the disappointment by ordinary Americans about the outlook for the economy. They're feeling their wages go down. And, you know, I can tell you, living in Washington, I know that's not a normal city because it has such a large government sector, but it's extraordinarily expensive. And I often think to myself, how does someone here on an ordinary income actually live and save anything? I mean, to buy a coffee in Washington, you know, you can't get a coffee for less than $7 Australian. You know, and that's just an exchange rate. You know, it's a $5 US for a coffee. So yeah, that is so much more expensive than Sydney, you know, or Melbourne. And you know, it's not just coffees, it's everything. It's haircuts. You know, a glass of wine is like $24 Australian if you want one here. I mean, it's just unbelievably expensive. Like I said, that's just Washington. But nevertheless, I mean, you know, these prices are going up all around the country and people are starting to feel it. I mean, in the conversations I have with colleagues and friends in Washington, everyone does talk about the cost of living here in a way no one did in Australia when I was there. No one talked about that as an issue. So the inflation and the expected interest rate increase is the big issue. I want to talk now about the huge debt surge that I mentioned earlier. And this really is, I think, a phenomenal thing that's happened. We've junked a lot of the principles and ideals and economics that we formulated in the 80s and 90s and held as very important. And one thing that really struck me greatly is that the increase in debt amongst the world's English-speaking nations has been bigger than anywhere else by far. Like I've just been so struck by it. So, of course, governments around the world have borrowed a great deal during COVID. They all have. But especially the US, Australia, and Canada, and New Zealand. So New Zealand, more than any other nation, they're number one. So they've increased their public debt to GDP by 26 percentage points just in 2 years, which is absolutely extraordinary. And second is Malta, which I'm counting as an English-speaking country because it was run by England for a long time. And then straight after that is the US and the UK and Australia. They stand out massively amongst the 35 nations that the IMF tracks closely. So there's been a massive increase in debt. And you know, these are huge sums. I mean, the US spent about $1 trillion on the Vietnam War, right? It was a huge war. It went for a decade. That's in dollars today. But their spending on COVID packages has been $5 trillion. So just a fifth on the Vietnam War. So just, I mean, these are just huge, huge sums. And it's very hard to explain why. I mean, Australia and New Zealand began with relatively low levels of debt. So you might explain, you know, that maybe because they had low levels of debt, they could spend more. But the UK and the US did not start with low levels of debt. They've just simply added to it. So there's been a huge change there. It's hard to know why these countries have spent so much. And I spent most of today thinking about it and trying to explain it. Part of it could be that perhaps the English language media was more hysterical about COVID, and so it created political environment where you could spend so greatly, so much. Or another reason I think perhaps could be that modern monetary theory, which has become increasingly popular in the English-speaking world amongst some economists, and this is the idea that budget deficits don't matter and governments can spend whatever they want. That idea is much more embedded in the English-speaking world than in Europe or elsewhere. So perhaps that's a reason. Or maybe the financial sector in those countries is much stronger in the English-speaking countries. I think that's true. I think as a lobby group, the banks and investment banks are much more powerful in those countries. And they benefit from a lot of public debt because they get to trade it. So maybe that's one reason. But look, I don't have an answer why. But the outcome of all this is that these English-speaking countries are at the vanguard of this giant experiment, this giant experiment in economics where you can spend an enormous amount of money and basically tell your voters that there's no real cost. And that's effectively what's been going on. There's been an extraordinary increase in debt. Taxes are actually falling in Australia soon. So there's a total disconnect between this extraordinary spending and taxation, and the same in the US. There's been no increase in tax anywhere near commensurate with the huge increase in debt. Even Democrats in Congress have really no interest in huge increases in taxation, only very token increases to signify that they're doing something. So the real test this year is whether this experiment is going to fail or succeed, and it's too early at this stage to know. Borrowing rates are still fairly low in the US and in Australia. So governments in both countries can still borrow for about 2% for 10 years, which is very low historically. So far, if you like, the experiment's working, but my fear is that in the next 5 to 10 years, it won't work. And all these enormous costs are going to come home to roost either in much higher inflation or a huge increase in taxation to pay off these debts. And so I'll just finish there and just leave you with the idea that we are at this kind of inflection point, if you like, where we've, borrowed massively. And so far, there's no cost to that. But I think in the next few years, there could be. And the countries that are at the forefront of that, canary in the coal mine, so to speak, are the five English-speaking countries of the world. So that's what Australia and the US at the moment have in common, that extraordinary increase in public debt. And so far, no cost. But we have to wait and see.
Well, many thanks, Adam, for a very comprehensive look at the US and then a brief glance at borrowing. So we start the question and discussion period. Put your hand up if you want to ask a question or wave to me or send a text. And we'll continue for no more than 35 minutes, maybe a bit less. So thanks for a look, among other things, at borrowing, which you, as you know, you highlighted primarily turning on English-speaking nations. But who are the lenders? Do we know that?
Well, the lenders are the central banks of the countries. That's what's so extraordinary about this. I mean, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet has tripled in the past 2 years to $9 trillion. So the lender is the central bank of the country. You know, the governments of Australia and the UK and America, they say they want to borrow this amount, and their central bank just creates the amount and gives it to them.
So what's the problem if the American central, the US central bank is lending to the US government? What's the problem there?
Well, the money supply has still grown hugely. And, you know, this is a massive debate amongst economists about whether the current inflation we're seeing is related to the money supply or it's related to supposed COVID bottlenecks, which is the favoured explanation of governments. They don't like to talk about the money supply because they know if they do, it's their fault. So they talk, you know, they blame COVID, they blame the pandemic. But I think that that's just politics. I think they're saying that as an easy reason. I mean, there's only so many goods and services in the economy, and money supply has grown massively, and so you'd expect a catch up in prices. And I think that's what we're seeing in the US and around the world. You know, inflation is not just a US issue at the moment. I mean, it's leading the pack with 7.5%, but you know, the Bank of England last week said it expects inflation of 7% soon in the UK. Look, I know it's only 3% in Australia, but it'd be unusual if it did, you know, if it did not increase much more. So these aren't just US problems.
So I'll be looking down a bit because I'm looking at my phone. So I'm going to go in this order: Joe, Mark, Anne, Anthony, and Ross. So Joe Gersh. Joe, are you there?
I am. I just had to unmute. Hi, Adam. How are you?
Joe, hi. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I'll be in the States hopefully in May, so I'll be able to buy you one of those $7 copies and relieve the pressure.
Thank you.
Why not go one better than a $24 glass of wine? Why not?
don't worry, Jared. Adam knows how to look after himself. He'll be fine. The question I wanted to ask you is, thank you for outlining the problem. What's the solution? Where do we go from here? If you were, and maybe refer it back to Australia as well. I mean, what is actually the way out?
Well, look, it's a good question. I mean, I think central banks are aware of the problem, and you know, I think treasuries are too in private. So they are slowing down the rate of borrowing. They are slowing the rate of money creation. But because there's such massive lags between growth of the money supply and the impact on inflation, basically the die's already cast for the next year. The inflation figures we're going to see in Australia and the US for the next 12 months are a function of what happened last year, not what happened now. So there's not much they can do. Political leaders are going to have to put up with all of this pain. You know, it depends on the outcome of the experiment. I mean, if this giant experiment succeeds, and I don't necessarily have a view. I mean, I'm aware that far smarter than people, far smarter minds than mine are in huge disagreement about this issue. So the economics profession does not, there's no consensus on this. You know, there's a lot of people who say, that this huge debt level's fine, interest rates are going to stay low. If that's true, then there's no great problem. But we still don't know whether it's true or not. I mean, my suspicion is it won't be true, but that's only a suspicion. There seems no such thing as a free lunch from the most basic economics going back centuries. But, there's a cost to everything. At least that's what I think. But so far, there doesn't seem to be a massive cost to the fact that, US debt has just gone through $30 trillion, up $6 trillion in just 2 years, right? I mean, that would have been considered completely insane about 10 years ago. Or maybe 15 years ago, completely insane. But it's happened, and it's happened in Australia. And it's extraordinary too how little discussion there has been about the increase in debt, especially Australia. When I kind of glance back to the news as I do, I mean, you've had this unbelievable increase in debt and huge waste, massive waste. I mean, you had JobKeeper payments going to surgeons and barristers, and buying artwork. I mean, I know this is true personally, with the money, but there's just no discussion about it really. No one seems to care. It's quite fascinating.
Should we go to Anne? Anne?
I'm just unmuting. That was great, Adam. I was interested in you saying that the participation rates dropped enormously, and we've still got very low unemployment figures. So Do we have any information as to who's dropping out of the workforce? I can understand productivity must be up if we've got a much smaller workforce, but how does this work out down the track? Are these older people dropping out earlier? Younger people, how are they financing their lives? What's the scenario there?
Yeah, so in the US, it's a mix of older people are leaving the workforce earlier. So they've lost their job and they already have savings, so they thought they just don't need to work anyway. And the other side is kind of younger people who got used to living on better welfare, which in the US was supercharged for about a year. So you had quite high payments for being unemployed, and in many cases higher payments for being unemployed than working. So that's, you drag people out of the workforce. And even though those payments have ended, they ended in December, it's still too early to know what the impact is, whether those people go back into the workforce or not. It's at both ends of the age spectrum, I would say, the people that have dropped out. But like I say, the emergency payments ended in December, so it's too early to know yet what the result of that's going to be.
But this would mean, though, a sort of social crisis if we have inflation, because these people will be on fixed incomes, like elderly people with their savings. I mean, this is going back to the 70s when we had older folk were really hit with inflation, and you've got people who've never experienced inflation not realising what it means.
Yeah, well, I mean, the older, retirees here, if they had 401ks or superannuation, I mean, they would have made a lot of money out of their appreciating stocks, right? You're 30% up, like I said, in 2 years. So I think the older generation, you know, the kind of middle class older generation, if you like, would be fine because they've seen a huge increase in their wealth. Sure, people on fixed pensions and so forth, fixed government US pensions would be struggling, but they've always struggled. Look, it's a difficult question. I don't know the answer.
Mark.
Thanks, Jared, and thanks, Adam, for giving us your time. I recall about 15 years ago, the then Secretary Treasury, Ken Henry, expressed his concern about the level of US debt at that time, which he described as unsustainable. Largely that debt was private debt or debt to other nations, a lot of it being held and increasingly held by China. Do we know what the breakdown now is between that level of external debt and the level of debt now created by the central bank? And has anybody done any analysis of the impact of those two streams of debt ownership in terms of the US?
Look, that's a good question. I don't have the figures on me, but the share owned, if you like, by foreigners would have shrunk because of that huge increase in debt of the central banks, not just in America, but around the world. So that kind of newly created debt, if you like, is being held domestically. But nevertheless, it is a large share. And look, I don't have the figure. I mean, if I had to guess, I'd say 20% is owned by Chinese investors, but I don't know for sure. It's a complicated question. And, you know, it's always been a political issue about, you know, Chinese and Russians owning US debt, but the fraction would have shrunk. And at the end of the day, you know, the Chinese and the Russians don't want to lose money on their investments either. So they'd be reluctant to, you know, all sell at once, you know, because they'd lose a lot of money.
Okay, the next question, do we know what the level of China and Russia's debt is? Has that also gone up?
Well, Russia's interesting because since 2014, since it invaded Ukraine the first time, it's systematically paid down a lot of its debt. It has huge foreign exchange holdings. It's nowhere near as vulnerable to foreigners as most Western countries are, and that's been a deliberate strategy because it expected another round of sanctions, which seem imminent. Because of its current behaviour. And also as an oil exporter, you know, it has massive kind of guaranteed incomes, if you like, which can't be turned off easily. Because countries need that, you know, they need the energy. Also, its gold reserves are enormous too. China has been building up its gold reserves over years, and so has China. So their fiscal position is very, very different from, you know, from the standard Western country.
Anthony?
I'd like just to confirm what has just been said, that the Russia's debt as a percentage of GDP is only 18%, and they've got reserves of $635 billion when I last looked, and they're getting $10 billion a month from their oil and gas. It's being squirreled away. They're in a pretty strong position. Now, my question, though, is, and also, how on earth can you can have quantitative easing without generating inflation is beyond my small intelligence. However, key question I was going to ask is, to what extent has the US economy restructured with a shift from businesses which traditionally involve some face-to-face contact to businesses which are on the internet? And is this going to be a permanent restructuring of the whole economy to businesses which can use the internet to businesses which traditionally have not used the internet?
Well, it's a very good question. Look, I don't know, because I don't know if there'd be any good statistics on that. But this is the whole work from home question, whether this is a permanent, like, structural change or not. I mean, I've been arguing the past 2 years that it's not permanent, and that we will eventually go back to, you know, 2019 lives. But it seems like I've been proven wrong, and maybe this seminar is an example of that. I mean, this is a legacy of COVID-19, the fact that we're doing this. And that's a good thing. But as someone who was trained in economics, you know, I was trained to think that there must be something rational about the equilibrium that we had in 2019. There's something, otherwise we would have done this before, but we weren't. So maybe we have learnt, if you like, as a society, and more things will be done online, which has huge ramifications ultimately for wages and salaries and the way companies pay people, especially high-income people. And I think one of the amusing things is the cheering from the Zoom class, you know, for shutdowns and so forth, because they quite enjoy working from home. Longer term, if it continues, those people will not get paid as much. At least that's what I think, because part of the compensation was they had to go into the office and they had to pay transport costs and they had to spend hours on the train. If those things aren't happening anymore, like, it won't happen overnight, but their pay will go down a lot. It hasn't started happening yet, but it certainly will. I mean, you're already seeing cases of big firms in the US and Australia, like law firms in services industries, threatening to move work to India and so forth, because, you know, they can do it there so much more cheaply. And what's the benefit of paying Americans and Australians to go on the, these huge rates if they're not even in the office? It's a very good question. I don't know how permanent that change is going to be, but it seems more permanent than I thought, actually. I mean, if you look at Washington now, you know, probably 80% of the public service are still at home. I mean, Washington is a dead city. It's completely dead. I mean, downtown is a joke. There's nothing, there's no cars, there's no pedestrians. It's extraordinary, 2 years on.
Ross.
Thank you very much, Adam. That was really informative. I'm chief economist at the Minerals Council. And I guess what I want to ask you is, it's probably two related issues, but the first one is, in terms of the debt problem, is there much discussion really being had with respect to how the US is going to deal with the problem in terms of options, or is it too early? Are people sort of just aware that it's a looming issue, but what to do about it is sort of yet to come? And the related question, it concerns the Federal Reserve. And you talked about this sort of giant experiment that's occurring with respect to the fiscal side, and we've obviously got a giant experiment occurring with respect to monetary policy around the world, and the need to sort of move from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening. No central bank has ever done this before. And what really is the potential for the Federal Reserve to increase interest rates significantly without crashing the economy?
Well, just on the first question about discussions about the debt, no, there's none. It's really remarkable, actually. I mean, there were some news stories recently about US debt going through $30 trillion. That was interesting, but there was no real analytical discussion about what that meant or whether that was a bad thing. Maybe the US is a different case because it still has the reserve currency of the world. It's the world's biggest economy, the world's richest economy. But it does shock me that there's so little concern about extraordinary budget deficit, which is still huge. It's still like $1 trillion a year or something is the US federal government's deficit. You know, that's the entire Australian economy, basically, if you like. That's the gap. You know, it's an enormous gap. And the Democrats tried to increase taxes a little bit last year in legislation, but they were very tokenistic increases, and they wouldn't have made any significant difference to revenues in the long term. So I don't think the Democrats even are interested in increasing taxes. It's not a discussion. I mean, the belief here is that we can just continue like this with no cost. And even amongst economists, the constituency for increasing taxes is almost zero, I would say. So many of them have been quite taken by the MMT ideas and, you know, the low interest, you know, permanent low interest rate ideas, that, you know, the idea of deficits being a problem, you know, which used to be the case in the 70s and 80s, that's completely evaporated. And on the Federal Reserve, look, I mean, I share your suspicion that they won't increase rates as much as people are forecasting, because last time they tried to do that in 2015-16, there was the so-called taper tantrum and markets sold off dramatically. And my view is central banks are kind of captured by the financial system in general, and they won't do anything that upsets the financial system or the investor class more generally. So I think they're more likely to let inflation run a bit out of control, I think, than lift rates. But that's just my view. But it's going to be very hard, because never as a society have we been so reliant on asset prices to generate confidence. Because, you know, such huge swathes of the economy own houses, they're leveraged, rely on stocks, you know, for their retirement. So lifting rates is bad for those things. So we'll see if they can do it or not. We'll see soon. That's why it's interesting.
And look, I think you raise a really important point here. Look, we've had no time like the present where the world economy is so financialized. And I think we're starting to sort of see some of the problems associated with that, in the capacity for central banks to operate under what we'd call normal conditions. But I also just quickly, you know, I think supporting the notion that they haven't got too much opportunity probably is reflected in where the bond yield curve in the US is trading at the moment, and also the stock market. They're concerned, but they're not terrified.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair summary.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to go Edward, Dennis and Jennifer. Edward?
Thank you. Thank you, Adam, for sharing your thoughts. I have a question which sort of was touched upon in your last answer, just on the credibility of central banks around the world. Do you think credibility across the globe, you know, with the central banks has been strengthened or weakened during the crisis? And I ask this question with two examples in mind. The US, you know, US Federal Reserve, they thought that inflation was going to be transitory. They messaged this throughout 2021. They underestimated the, the problems with like supply chain shortages. And then that led to, you know, inflation being more permanent. And a second example, with the RBA, you know, they had a policy called yield curve control. They wanted to target a certain rate for the 3-year bond. Back then it was the 3-year bond, and they pretty much had to ditch it once, investors just pretty much sold that bond. So do you think our credibility has been strengthened or weakened?
Look, I think certainly weakened. I mean, certainly weakened. You mentioned the RBA there, and my recollection is that there was a promise by Phil Lowe that rates would not increase till 2024. Mm. I think he ditched that 2 weeks ago, didn't he? I mean,
yeah, pretty much.
Why do they make these promises if they're going to be ditched in a few months? I mean, I think it certainly undermines central bank credibility. And look, I mean, the central banks have been living in the glow of low inflation for a couple of decades, which they said was their own doing. I mean, I've been very skeptical about that. I thought that it was maybe a coincidence, really, that we had low inflation because of China's entry into the global trading system and various other factors that, frankly, had not much to do with central banks. But now this, we're seeing a real test. You've got inflation well above targets in pretty much all Western countries. And you can have that for a few months, maybe a year, maybe at most. But at some point, if they don't fix it, then, they're going to have no credibility. So that's the big test this year, is whether the Fed can get inflation back to 2%, which is quite a big ask from 7.5. It creates interesting political dynamics because central banks are independent nominally, but I mean ultimately they're still government entities. So it'll be interesting to see how far they can go in terms of hurting the economy to get inflation back to their target. Frankly, I don't think that far. I mean, I think they'll be very worried about what their political masters think about the situation.
And just on that, so the...
Got to be brief, okay.
Yep. Okay, just with the RBA, I mean, they said that they wouldn't lift the cash rate until 2024. I believe that was a three-year projection. Do you think that sort of... what's the point of sort of forecasting... 3 years out, let alone 1 year out. Does this sort of show something that's sort of problematic econometrics, economic forecasting in general?
Economic forecasting is, largely a waste of time. And it's, it's a gift for economics reporters because it gives us something to write about, but they're always wrong. I mean, the RBA, to its credit, 5 years ago or something, put out a paper that just said that their forecasts were worse than a coin toss. And it wasn't just theirs, it was the entire financial community. So, we put way too much value on what central banks think is going to happen.
Jennifer. Hi, Adam. How are you going?
Hi, good, thanks.
I've often listened to you on Sky and your commentary is excellent. So thanks very much. I'd just like to know that there's always, quite a lot of murmurings and commentary about, the fragility of China. And, Gordon Chang's been banging on about it for quite some time. But from a US perspective, is there anything that, that could be happening? Because no one really knows exactly, what their, how their economy is doing, because nothing is shared, as you know. Yet they appear to be going from strength to strength. So from a US perspective, is there any concerns or anything, or, is there... anything that you can share, please. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, that's a good question. I think Australia has been a bit of the canary in the coal mine with the Chinese power. And I think we realized a couple of years before the US did that it was a great problem. The series of legislation that Turnbull government passed, about Chinese influence, made China very angry. But I think back then the US wasn't really doing much, but I think now there is a greater awareness that China is, kind of the strategic enemy very much. And there's far more awareness of that, I'd say, in Washington. Far more discussions, think tank events about Chinese power than there would have been 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, as to the inherent strength of China, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's so hard to read that. From first principles, I think it has to be a brittle regime with a lot of internal problems because... you can't believe a lot of what they say, and who knows what the reality is. So I think longer term that kind of totalitarian regime will collapse in some way, or it'll change into something better or more liberal. But for the meantime, that doesn't seem as though it's going to happen anytime soon. So look, I mean, I think there's a sense in the US, the US is still the most powerful country in the world. I think it is. But there's just, there's a great awareness that China is rising. So, but look, I know that's not a great answer, but it's just, China's so inscrutable. I just don't know what to say about it.
Can I have a quick backup question, please? Can I have a quick backup question? All it is that they appear to have a lot of influence over the United Nations, the WTO, World Economic Forum, etc. So that influence, which, you know, is there anything else that could be coming, you know, that we're unaware of, that they're going to sort of push them back?
Okay. Because we've got to move on. Yeah, quick response, Adam.
Oh, well, just you reminded me of the influence that China has on the big tech companies here, which are extremely powerful now. And they're all trying to curry favour, Twitter's, Facebook's of the world, to get into the Chinese market. So that is a real problem in the US, because they're very powerful politically now. They're censoring things, and they also want to get into the Chinese market. So that's a real problem. That's what I should have said earlier.
Thank you.
Dennis's question has come through on a text. Given that money supply has massively increased across the West, are the price rises in food, energy and accommodation now permanent?
Well, they're inevitable, I think. I mean, like I say, the money supply increase has happened and you can't kind of reverse it. So there's a huge lag, you know, of 12 months to 18 months for these, you know, for these phenomena to play out. So I think, yes, I think the inflation spike is going to last at least 6 to 12 months in the US. And it's going to, you know, be higher in Australia too.
We're getting close to the end, so everyone's got to be pretty brief. Mark?
Thanks. Just a second bite. In 2007, Australia had no net debt, and that was achieved by discipline in relation to spending, which Tanya and I and many others experienced at the time. There appears to be no discipline now in relation to spending. Our levels of debt mean that promises can be made outrageously without any discipline in relation to where the money's going to come from. And we'll see more of it leading into the federal election. Do you have any observations?
Yeah, well, look, I agree with you. I mean, there's just no discipline now. I mean, I look back to Australia and, you know, all these arguments for we need free RATs and free PCR tests, and everyone just wants everything for free. There's absolutely no consideration of the cost of these things. You know, just on testing alone, we've spent billions in Australia, you know, many, many billions. Well, in Australia, hundreds of millions anyway, but certainly around the world, an enormous amount. And there's just no sense that this is all, you know, this is all public money. You know, 20 years ago, the zeitgeist was very different. At least that's my sense and my memory even. I think credibility's gone. But like I say, so far, there's no sign that this experiment has failed. So until that happens, I think the voters are going to continue to expect more and more spending with no cost.
Early on, you made the observation that that the Biden administration had inherited a lot of the economic problems, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's what happens a year or so after a change of government. It's very much the new administration's taking in the existing situation, but. What about the Biden administration's decisions in relation to oil developments, pipelines, that kind of thing? Has that had any impact on prices yet? Has it had any impact on general policy in relation to America's independence in energy?
Well, look, it's a good question. Look, I mean, to my knowledge, they haven't changed rules too much. The only rule that jumps out to me straight away then when you asked was that they actually shifted nuclear power to the green list, which is actually quite a good decision. So they've made nuclear energy like one of the net zero sources of energy, because I think the US is realizing that there's no way it can achieve these promises, which the Biden administration's made, you know, 30% down by 2030 without more nuclear power. And this is not just the US, you're seeing it in France, you're seeing it in Netherlands. So I think certainly there is an anti-fossil fuel push in the Biden administration, but there's also a realization that nuclear energy is a good thing too. So it's not all been bad. And look, I can't answer the specifics, Jared, on the regulations changes with oil, but certainly the oil price is up a lot. So
just tell us about yourself. You've got how much longer to be in Washington, and we got any idea about the midterm elections in November? Anything to report?
Well, look, I hope I'm here for another 3 years. That's the normal standard. Look, I mean, I expect that there will be a landslide for Republicans in November. I think the political climate here right now is quite toxic for Democrats, and it's largely, created by their own doing. They do a lot of seemingly silly things with a obsession with mask mandates. Masking children is now the big issue, I would say, in the US, probably for ordinary people. Huge arguments over whether it should be compulsion or not. And the cultural issues, critical race theory, which, frankly, I'd never heard of in Australia until I came here, is an enormous issue here. And it sounds a very esoteric thing, but, basically it's just the idea that you teach, well, you're obsessed in the classroom with race issues and the fact that, white people should be permanently guilty, basically. And, that seems a weird niche issue by Australian standards, but it actually really swung the Virginia election, I would say, recently. A Republican won there. And the Republicans have been very emboldened by that outcome, and they're going to run the same campaign all this year, basically, in all the states, basically about parents, a relationship with schools. That's the huge issue. And so at the same time, you've got that, this belief that the Democrats are more and more out of touch with ordinary Americans, you've got this high inflation as well. So look, it's a terrible outcome for Biden. I mean, it might not be as bad as expected if inflation falls and all the restrictions go and there's no more COVID wave. But, if there's a seventh wave between now and November, which you couldn't rule out given there've been six, will the Democrats try to pull back the mandates? I don't know. It'd be very hard to do politically. So, so my expectation is for a Republican rout. But still, it's 8-9 months away. It's still a long way away. Anything could happen.
And just finally, as Virginia is very close to, or a large part of Virginia is very close to Washington, D.C. So if it's impacting there, it would have a greater impact possibly elsewhere in the United States, the reaction to that. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, the interesting thing is between Virginia and D.C., and yes, they are very, very close. And in terms of the mandates in D.C., which is a lot stricter on masks and vaccine passports and so forth, you're already seeing a lot of businesses shift to Virginia. And I think that's quite interesting. In fact, D.C. lost a huge conference just last week, like 1,000 people conference. Can't remember the name, but they were just fed up with all the rules and they moved it to Virginia. So certainly there's been a lot of movement within the United States. Actually, I should have mentioned perhaps the internal migration has just been extraordinary. So you've had the largest movements of people basically on record for whatever reason, but from New York and California to Florida and Texas, there've been hundreds of thousands of people literally have moved in the last 2 years. The trend was already there, but there was an extraordinary acceleration. And you'd have to think in part that's to do with Democrat schooling policy and all the other COVID stuff. I mean, personally, I know people who've moved from New York to Florida, journalists actually, a kind of important journalist with good jobs, and they've just been fed up with New York. So they're doing their job now from Miami, which is the same time zone. That's just an anecdote, but it's having big impacts internally.
Well, Adam, we could go on, but we don't. We're right on time. So on behalf of Anne, who I think you negotiated this, and myself, thanks for a great performance, and we'll keep reading you in the Australian online and in the print edition and watch you on Sky News, etc. So well done and thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks, Jared.